From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the August 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Whitehall, 7947.
2nd of August, 1939. Move of service sections to Warsite, 15th of August, 1939. In order to carry out communication tests, the warsite will be manned AM 15th August by those detailed in GCNCS First Wave, who are not on leave at the time. All documents required at the warsite are to be packed by 5:30 PM on 14th August. They will be moved during that night. As many as possible are to be placed in small cupboards and filing cabinets which can be locked. Arrangements for labelling will be promulgated later. Stationery has already been sent down. Sufficient personal luggage should be taken for 15 days. Those going by train should obtain a single ticket of the appropriate class to Bletchley. On arrival, they should place their luggage in the cloakroom, from whence it will be collected after the allocation of billets, etc. They should proceed on foot from the station to the warsite, inquiring if necessary for Bletchley Park, which is on the up or west side of the railway. On leaving the station, turn right up the hill and proceed through the second lodge gates. Suitable trains from Euston are the 8:37 AM and the 9:30 AM. An advance for railway tickets can be obtained from Mr. Travis. The address for official correspondence and private letters will be Room 47 Foreign Office, and the official telephone number, Whitehall 7947.
I've called this episode Whitehall 7947. But what we should probably subtitle it is the Early Days Exhibition. I've got our usual host, but also exhibitions manager, Erica Munro, with me. Erica, what's Early Days all about?
The Early Days Exhibition is our latest exhibition that we have opened on the ground floor of the mansion. It explores the very start of Bletchley Park as a code-breaking centre, starting from the purchase of the park and the relocation of GCNCS from London to Bletchley, and follows a chronological route through to the early work and successes, sort of end of 1939, start of 1940.
Now, regular listeners might be thinking, you did an episode called It Happened Here, Early Days, a couple of years ago, I'm sure. And we did, but this episode is going to be more specifically about this exhibition. So Erica's here to talk to us about the actual physical exhibition. And then we're also going to have Thomas, our research officer, dipping in and tell us about his work that has helped to create this exhibition. So, Erica, why early days now?
The earliest days of Bletchley Park's code-breaking story is something we really didn't have a chance to talk about anywhere in detail on the site.
Yep.
It was a big gap in what we call our core narrative. And this exhibition is a perfect opportunity to have a space dedicated to telling that story, literally in the place that it happened, in the mansion, which is the first building that was used for code-breaking in 1938 at Bletchley Park. So we wanted to locate that exhibition in this really prominent place, but it also means that we had some space, some physical space to explore a few different themes, a few different areas. We had covered the story in our multimedia guides, for example, our excellent tour guides on site, our website and so on. But this is part of our visitors' experience now. So it was a big gap that we have now filled. Visitors previously would visit the mansion and see some set dressed areas such as the library and Denniston's office that gave kind of snapshots of what it may have looked like to work in there.
But there was no sort of explanation of
it,
was there?
Exactly. And that story, why Bletchley Park, I think is a question that quite often gets asked that wasn't really answered for the majority of our visitors. So this look at those earliest sort of year and a bit, those earliest months, gives us a chance to look at the people and the work and the reasons behind some of the decisions, and also look at the challenges that were faced, because it was not an easy time, as I'm sure you can imagine.
This exhibition is slightly different to other ones, isn't it? It's kind of split up into scenes, isn't it?
It is, exactly. Well, we wanted to... Well, first of all, we're limited by the size of the room. We cannot make the room any larger, much as I'm sure we would love gallery after gallery to be able to do it. So we knew that we wanted it to fit in the mansion in this one particular room, which is the drawing room. And so with our focus on a family audience, we knew that we didn't want to put too much writing in. We did some research with our family audiences and found that, well, pretty much what we already knew, too many words just definitely puts people off. Mm. They like exploring. They want to have different ways into the story through different media, through different means, objects and interactives and multimedia, as well as some text, but also an easy to follow route around the room where you can go in and a family can immediately see this is what I'm going to be doing and kind of get an immediate understanding of what they'll be experiencing in that space. So our designers, Easy Tiger Creative, came to us with this very theatrical approach, which we were just thrilled with. They even showed us a picture of a stage that had four distinct scenes in it, where the action would take place in one scene, but the others would remain lit. And that was kind of our starting point, our inspiration for this room. We knew we wanted it to feel like an early room in the mansion.
Yeah.
Higgledy-piggledy, paperwork everywhere, sort of bits of random furniture, some of it really decadent, some of it just sort of trestle tables and folding chairs. And it all to feel like that as soon as you got in the room, but then by following around these five scenes that we've put in and exploring a bit deeper, you can kind of pull out some of the stories that are in each of those locations.
The staff are warned against any conversations regarding the work with other members of the staff whilst in their billets. If occasion should arise as to what you are doing, the answer should be that you are part of the aerial defence of London. This test is to be treated with the utmost secrecy by all members of this department. Gas masks are to be taken.
Eric has taken us through the physical layout of the exhibition. But to get to that state, a lot of research needs to be done. And that's why, here at Bletchley Park, we not only have a research historian, but luckily, in the last couple of years, we've also had the services of Dr. Thomas Cheetham, who regular listeners will have heard in lots of our podcast episodes. And Thomas's actual role is research officer. This has kind of been your baby for a while now, hasn't it?
It has. This was sort of the first project that I was committed to
after arriving here,
which is quite a while back now. And it does take a long time to go from first steps to having an open exhibition that people can visit. And there's a lot of steps on that journey. Goes from deciding what you want to say and then being able to verify what you can say. And that's always the problem with Bletchley Park, the opportunity, I suppose, as well. There is so much information and knowledge, things that people know about this place floating around.
Or think they know,
but to pin it down, to verify it, and to be able to say this is a historical fact and it's not something that's come about later on, it's not a misapprehension and it's not a piece of mythology, is very, very important. And everything that goes into our exhibitions is verified. The challenge with early days was to narrow things down to what we can verify. Because we're talking about the early period of the story, obviously, appears in all of the books. It's an essential part of the story, and it's a very widely discussed story. But that contrasts very strongly with the amount of information we actually have available, because it is the least documented period of the war. And that means being able to verify a lot of these facts has been challenging at times. And we've had to be very, very discerning about what goes into the exhibition. On the other hand, we have learned new things as well. And we have deepened our understanding in certain areas, especially around recruitment, and been able to add a new dimension to the story, which wasn't there before.
Well, you saying it was one of your first tasks here. I remember that document, your research document, it was 92 pages, wasn't it?
I think so, yes. Yeah. That sounds about right.
I was looking at it again recently. And we based one of the first episodes that you appeared in, the early days episode, where we didn't it happened here episode, talking about those early days. Am I right in saying that you've even learnt things since then?
Yeah, we're always adding to it. And obviously in the process of deciding what you want your exhibition to look like, you come up with a sort of a narrative of it, which is a step beyond my research document. And there are things which are emphasised and things which fall by the wayside a little bit. So I found recruitment was the key thing that I wanted to talk about in my document. And we turned that into one scene out of five in the finished exhibition. So there were those other areas where more work had to be done to flesh it out, of course, and to tell the story that we wanted to tell for the visitors.
All this research is going through countless documents, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about that, because this is kind of your dream job, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very nice job because I get to go to the archives whenever I like and leaf through them and find interesting stuff. You say countless documents. If you look at the whole of Bletchley Park's history, there is far more on record than I expected to find.
Yeah.
When I came in knowing that it was all secret and classified and it only had recently had stuff started to be released into the public sphere. But there is still an awful lot there, and they come up with a huge bureaucracy almost to run it, and that creates large amounts of documentation. And I don't think anyone has been through it all, although some people have made very sterling efforts to do that. But to read it all is an enormous task, one that I'm very happy to attempt. But even I haven't really scratched the surface at this stage. On the other hand, for the early days period at the start of the story, very, very little survives, because at that stage in the war, obviously there was things were very, very chaotic.
Mm.
GC and CS didn't really have an administration at the start of the war, and that all has to be built up pretty much from scratch. And so the documentation they make is the bare minimum they need to run things.
Yeah.
They're trying to prioritise the actual work.
Well, how many staff did they have, you know, down in London before they came to the war station?
They had about 120. So it's a small enough organisation that you can sort of run it just by keeping in touch with people in the neighbouring offices.
Yeah.
You don't need that centralisation. You don't need enormous amounts of paperwork. So they make do without it. It's easy for us nowadays with computers to do a lot of this. It can be automated and it can be run very, very efficiently. But if you want to run a big organisation in the 1940s, you need facilities, you need large amounts of paper, you need people to organise them, you need files, you need typists to produce all this stuff.
You need filing cabinets, which they didn't have in 1938.
They didn't have in 1938, exactly. You have a whole level of logistics which just doesn't exist today in our sort of relatively paperless offices as we have them. That all, as I say, is built up during the war. The admin section here becomes large and takes up a lot of space, actually.
Now, with this being this different form of exhibition with these scenes, have you had to approach it differently in creating it?
We knew the subject that we wanted to cover,
yeah,
the early days of Bletchley Park's code-breaking story. But we also had a quite specific target audience in mind, as a primary target audience, which is intergenerational groups, families, yeah, but not necessarily families, where the children are aged 8 or older. Because if you want to target an exhibition for sort of much younger children, you really do have to do a kind of quite different interpretation approach. It is. We had a couple of secondary audiences as well, sort of adult groups and school groups and so on. But that family or intergenerational audience is the one that we're targeting. We really do need to target our exhibitions. It does mean that to some extent we're not focusing on our entire audience demographic, but also if you target it to everybody, you end up actually appealing to nobody.
Mm.
So we had to be quite specific. So we did a fair amount of visitor research. We spoke to families, we spoke to school teachers, we spoke to homeschoolers. We did a big online evaluation survey, yeah, as well, to find out what it is that these audiences wanted to experience in the exhibition, but also what they kind of understood of the story already, what their preconceptions were, and the most interesting areas that we could focus on. In addition to that, we also did, and I say we, I wasn't the one that did this. In fact, Tom did some original research for it as well, and produced a huge amount of research looking at a huge variety of sources of material, which gave us a really solid, really rigorous underpinning for what we could include in the exhibition. We also did some research on our existing collections that we hold at Bletchley Park Trust to see what objects we could display and what photographs we could use. And we realised there is very little actually surviving from that time. And so we knew we had to have a hands-on, interesting, engaging, explorative exhibition for a family audience within a very limited physical space that told a very detailed story, but in a really brief way. So
everything, really.
Pretty much. So with that in mind, we then worked towards kind of our initial concept, which is really focusing on a main theme and shaving off quite a lot. The way that you turn a very detailed historical story into a gallery is you just have to focus in on a couple of bits. Mm. Otherwise, we're just blinding people with too much information, drowning them in words. So we then started developing our concept with our main theme of the mansion is where Bletchley Park's code-breaking story began, and developed it from there, really, where we followed these 5 scenes through and looked at how can we give different ways into the same sort of stories that we're telling in each of these scenes through design, through the words that we use, through the sounds that we're able to play in the space, through the feelings we're able to evoke, and through activities and challenges and problems that we can set our visitors to think about.
Because there is some hands-on stuff.
There is, absolutely. And we tried to have quite a variety of those. Initially, we very much wanted digital interactives. We know that visitors, particularly family visitors, love that. But also, budget limitations mean that you can't turn everything digital. And very often, you don't need to. No. Sometimes analog is absolutely fine. And so within these five scenes, which are set-dressed, sort of office-y scenes, so there's desks and set dressing on top of that, and then drawers that can be opened and things can be looked at. But within that, we also have index card boxes with challenges on clipboards, inviting visitors to think about a particular challenge that someone in that scene at that time, whether it was purchasing the park in 1938 or it was the outbreak of war in 39, the sort of challenges that an individual may have faced, like Denniston, for example, who was trying to organise this ever-changing organisation, and give our visitors some options about what would they prioritise or what would they choose to do, and just really kind of get into the mindset of how challenging it must have been at the time with all of these personnel and teams changing around, but also the international situation changing so fast as well.
Of course, the elephant in the room, or the elephant that's walking out of the room, hopefully, is all of this has been done during a pandemic, hasn't it?
We prepared, designed and produced and built the exhibition whilst Bletchley Park was closed to the public. And also we had to design it with the potential threat that COVID wasn't going away anytime soon. So the exhibition had to be designed in a way that anything handling could be wiped clean, for example, or anything that wasn't could be easily removed without leaving a big gap until it could be added at a later date. The one-way route around the room as well, so we didn't have people backing up on themselves. Being able to allow a group to move on without feeling they've missed out on too much. So spacing and pace of the room had to take into account that we didn't want people causing a bottleneck or a backlog. All sorts of things about social distancing and handling and no audio points. We had this wonderful idea about having quotes. You'd lift up a telephone and you'd hear the voice of Denniston, for example, saying something. And we just couldn't do that because of the proximity of the audio point to somebody's face.
Yeah, that's made lost out some work.
Well, we have, however, been able to find ways over this. So we put a soundscape into the room, which varies at different locations in the room. Any handling documents, and we've put in quite a lot of original documents from the National Archives, but we've put those into wipe clean folders with wipe clean pages on tables where they can't be removed and sort of messed about with. We have used materials that can be easily cleaned as well. So it was a real challenge, a design challenge, but also a content challenge and an interpretation challenge as well, as to how to make this exhibition, of which the exhibition's lifespan is 10 years. It's one of our permanent exhibitions, but how to do it in the time of COVID, where it could still be acceptable from day one that we opened.
How's this actually been funded, this exhibition?
We were lucky enough to get funding from the Culture Recovery Fund, which again is connected to the COVID pandemic. And so that enabled us in this sort of awful lull where we couldn't welcome visitors to the site to continue with this work at a mad pace so that we would be ready for when visitors came back in again to have this brand new exhibition from scratch, basically.
Hello? Ah, hello, sir.
I sent over a decrypt.
Rightio. Well, if you could leave this with me, sir, I'll just give it a quick once over and be back to you in a jiffy.
All right.
Until then, sir. Goodbye.
We kind of get brought up on the myth that the end of the war, everything gets burnt. Like you say, you didn't expect there to be all this paperwork. But it's that minutiae, that, you know, the day-to-day running of the site that really fills in the picture, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So that's where my first point of departure is that documentation. If it's from the hand or from the typewriter of somebody who was there, it's verifiable, it's contemporaneous. And therefore, it has an authenticity which a memory doesn't necessarily have, or a later memoir doesn't necessarily have. That's where you have to start, and that creates your framework, and then you can look at the oral histories and the memoirs.
To kind of flesh it out.
Yeah, exactly, to flesh it out. And also the histories that are written just at the end of the war, those are of enormous help to us in our work. But even those are 5 or 6 years distant from the events they describe sometimes.
And they also might not be the person who was running that section.
Exactly. Yeah, took the words right out of my mouth. So, yeah, the people writing these histories often arrived a little bit after things have got running at Bletchley because, but, you know, by dint of the fact that there weren't that many people here at the start. And they do write, you know, comments to the effect that I'm dependent here on the memories of my colleagues who were here at the time, but there is no documentation surviving. This is the commonly understood narrative of how things started, but we're not really sure. That was only a few years ago. So what you can do, you know, from a distance of 70 or 80 years is really limited. So you have to pin everything you possibly can to the original contemporaneous documentation. They're mostly not held here at Bletchley Park because when GCHQ decided to start releasing documents, they went first to the National Archives in Kew. They sort of get first dibs and they hold most of the really obviously important working papers, the product of all the code breaking and things like that. And we at Bletchley have anything that they decided not to take, either because they regarded it as insufficiently interesting, but you know, we're details people here, so we might find that there's a lot of value in it once we can look at it in more detail, or because it replicates something that's at Kew.
We also tend to get archives left to us, don't we, by our veterans?
Yeah, so that's the strength of our collection, is what's left to us by the veterans. In some cases, that does lead wartime documents to us because in some cases, veterans came into possession of these things that they probably shouldn't have been taking home with them.
Well, our handwritten D-Day.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good example. Yeah. Thank God some people did break the rules.
Yes.
So helpful to us now. But we have some really fantastic items came to us through that slightly illicit route, but they are few and far between. We have a lot of personal ephemera. We have sort of everyday items that can illuminate what life was like here. And we have all those reminiscences, which are all important in fleshing out the documentation, because that is the downside of this documentation. It is dry, it's formal, it's sort of procedural. It doesn't give you a good picture of the human story.
No.
It doesn't actually give you a perfect picture of the everyday work either, because this was an organisation that was defined by its informality and by people not following the rules, not following the procedures. So you don't get the full story from the documentation. You know, if you get a memo that says this is the way things should be done, you always have to think, well, was it actually done that way? Or does this give a more formal picture of the situation than really existed? Because people always broke the rules. People who work in offices nowadays will know that people never follow the procedures.
I don't know what you mean.
They're given. And especially true at a place like Bletchley that thrives off nonconformity and improvisation, which are Bletchley's strengths, but actually cause problems for us when we're trying to work out how things actually worked.
Bletchley Station. Cambridge train calling at Benny Stratford, Woburn Sands, Richmond.
Can you take us through scene by scene what visitors will see and what our listeners, if they can't get to Bletchley Park, are missing out on?
Shall I paint a picture in words?
Yes.
As I've said, there are these five scenes. So visitors go into the mansion and into the drawing room, which is one of the two rooms right on the front of the mansion with the big windows. And they are greeted by the introduction, which tells them that this is where Bletchley Park's code-breaking story begins. There are some suitcases there. They kind of get a sense of arrival and think, tell me more, hopefully. And they can also see the entire room in front of them. They'll see five different areas with, for example, this sort of window on the wall in one. There's a big bookcase. There's some notice boards, books piled up, and various bits of furniture sort of scattered about. So this won't feel alien to them. They may have seen it in the library already, this sort of sense of chaotic work. Yeah. But they move to scene one, which is not at Bletchley Park. We slightly controversially decided to put scene one in London. And this is because GCNCS didn't begin at Bletchley Park. It's something we found others just didn't perhaps understand. They sort of think the history began at Bletchley, but it absolutely didn't. And so in this scene, our visitors are greeted with an impression of the office of Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair, the head of SIS, who was also the head of GCNCS and who was the boss of Commander Alistair Denniston. In this office, we have placed some paperwork that is associated with the purchase of Bletchley Park, for which he was responsible. We have put some authentic paperwork, such as the map that was accompanying the sales documents when the park was originally sold by its owners to a developer, and then also information about the sale from the developer Faulkner to Sinclair when GC&CS purchased the park for its use in wartime. We also have an aerial photograph of the site at the time showing the sort of pristine, unblemished site, no huts, no...
There was a maze and everything, wasn't
there? A maze! It's so good from the air as well. It looks so wonderful where Hut 11A now stands. And there's a map of Bletchley at the time as well, which shows the proximity to the railway and also the location near but not too near to the town and the huge amount of sort of green space around where there are no buildings, no camps, no sort of outbuildings and so on. So visitors have a chance to really kind of get stuck in and explore and see a bit about not only the things that maybe Sinclair himself saw, but also they're faced with the challenge, if you were Sinclair, what do you think your priority would be when moving GC&CS from London to Bletchley?
Bedlington, Millbrook, Bedford. All stations to Cambridge.
Everyone knows the story of this, don't they? But do they?
Well, again, it was a matter of what we could verify. And the problem here is with sources, the decision to buy the park for MI6, not for the Codebreaker specifically, but for the whole of SIS or MI6, was the decision of Admiral Sir Hugh Sinclair, who's head of the Secret Intelligence Service. And therefore, if there is documentation of this decision-making process, we don't have access to it. So we have to use a bit of conjecture and read between the lines of what's going on and maybe think about what must have been the rationale behind his decision, but we can't necessarily evidence it very well. And that's made it a bit tricky. We know the story of how Hubert Faulkner, the Canadian officer turned property developer, buys the park from the Leon family in 1937. And he's thinking about developing it for housing. And he gets the iconic mansion and actually isn't enormously interested in it. It's not very useful to him, but it is attractive to Sinclair. And Sinclair comes across Bletchley Park and discovers Faulkner is willing to part with the mansion. Initially, they just actually purchase the area immediately around the mansion. The rest of the estate comes later.
Oh, right.
They actually buy it in chunks as they need space for more and more buildings.
Really?
Yeah. So this is something that's not that well known.
Because we're always told Sinclair puts his hand in his pocket and he buys it and that's it all done.
Yeah. So Sinclair somehow finds out the park is available, discusses with Faulkner, comes to an agreement. He buys it in his own name. The story is always that he buys it with his own money. We think that's unlikely. And that's because of the chronology of what happens after he dies. He dies very early in the war, and the property passes to his sister Evelyn, who he's very close to and has involvement herself in MI6 and GC&CS. It's only in 1943 that the property is actually passed over to the government.
And what year does Sinclair die?
In 1939.
Oh, is it 30? Is it
yeah,
that early?
Just a couple of months after war breaks out. But when Evelyn hands it over to the authorities, she doesn't claim any money in return. So we make the assumption that Sinclair wasn't using his own money. He was using one of these dark accounts that MI6 certainly would have had access to. He's using funds which aren't necessarily...
Not on the Foreign Office books.
Exactly. But they are public funds nonetheless for projects such as this that Sinclair might see as necessary.
The swastika and the Union Jack fly side by side on the Munich airport, and from the moment that Mr. Chamberlain steps onto German soil, we present a complete record of the historic journey of Britain's Prime Minister. From the airport, he drives past Heils and Cheers to the station, where a special train waits to carry him up towards the mountains of Berchtesgaden. With the snow-capped peaks in the distance, with the mountain winds swishing past him, Mr. Chamberlain drives up the steep road to the chalet that the German Chancellor has made his home. As the car comes up the long drive, a Hitler is on the steps to meet his guest, and the moment has come when the Prime Minister of Britain and the Chancellor of Germany clasp each other's hands. In such superb surroundings, the fateful talks begin.
Paint me a picture of scene two, Erica.
Sure, we move from scene one to scene two, but a few steps away brings us, we're still in 1938. It's September 1938, and we are now moving to the bit of Bletchley Park's history that's commonly known as Captain Ridley's shooting party. That first initial, some say test move from London up to Bletchley, where GC&CS spent from 18th of September to the 9th of October, working at Bletchley Park as a response to the Munich crisis. And so we wanted to reflect the atmosphere of the move in this scene. So we have a trestle table, we have a newspaper from the time as well. We've tried to use this motif of newspapers in each of the scenes. So we have real newspapers from each of these sort of approximate dates that we've pinned each scene to, that just kind of with the headlines that give a sense of what was going on at the time. We also have a copy of the photograph, that earliest photograph that many of our listeners will be familiar with of Captain Ridley's shooting party, the first known picture of the Codebreakers at Bletchley Park in the front of the mansion. And we also have quite a strong soundscape in this space of telephones ringing, and we've actually got visuals of stacks of papers. We know that in this initial move, work started straight away the next morning. You know, it all got delivered up here and people were hard at work, because the paperwork had arrived and the people had arrived, but the furniture hadn't, and so it was chaotic.
Yes, that's why in the movement order of the next year, there's a lot of mention of filing cabinets.
Definitely. And actually, there was a report written by William F. Clark, who wrote up, effectively, lessons learned from this sort of short period at Bletchley Park, as well as the move, and identified in quite strong terms where it had gone wrong. I think that's why people term it a test move, because of that really beneficial lesson learning that went on. There weren't enough people. For example, everybody was working, so who's going to deliver the messages between rooms? There's not enough people to answer the phones and so on. So it was a bit of an experience for GCNCS to work out how it may work during wartime, but they did go back to London. And in this scene, we wanted to show that chaos, the slight madness, the, I want to say disorganisation, but it was an organised move. So it's that kind of balance of work is continuing, and very important work is continuing.
The premises at Station X were adequate for the work actually carried on there during the period, but the room allotted to naval, military and air sections, while sufficient for the immediate purpose, did not meet the needs of war. The necessary expansion of staff, if war had come, would have overcrowded the room provided, and no provision was made for the keeping of a night watch. The billeting arrangements made were far from satisfactory. No discrimination seems to have been used in allotting members of the staff to quarters suitable to their age and standing. This was not the fault of the officer responsible, but was due to a lack of knowledge on his part of any facts but the mere names of those for whom he had to provide.
Extracts from the October 1938 report, Test Move to Station X, by W.F. Clark.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. We are resolved that the method of consultation shall be the method adopted to deal with any other questions that may concern our two countries, and we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe.
We then move to our third scene.
Scene three focuses on the early recruitment. Again, we're still pre-outbreak of war here, so late 1938, early 1939. This is that time when Denniston was busy recruiting people for the organisation that GCNCS may become should war break out. Yeah. We talk about identifying potential recruits and who may have been noticed for having particular skills or aptitudes or being the right sort of person. And in this scene, we're able to use media. We have a film set into a very large bookcase. I should say that we're back out of Bletchley Park again in this scene. We've moved to Cambridge University and the office of a professor in Cambridge. The Oxbridge universities were prime locations for the recruitment at that time of people. to go and work at GCNCS or who could be useful to GCNCS. So we wanted to locate it in that place. And we've got a couple of armchairs where perhaps one of those cozy talks may have taken place. There may be a job that interests you, but I can't tell you too much about it, sort of thing. And also, it's a chance for us to talk about some of the people that have been identified. Now, Tom's research has identified everybody that was selected as a potential recruit, male and female, for different levels of work, many of which, most of which, didn't end up working at Bletchley Park. People like J.R.R. Tolkien, for example, and then some who did, Turing, Welshman. We're also able to see that some people were identified as potential codebreakers, like Martin Charlesworth, who actually ended up not coming to Bletchley Park, but staying at his college as a recruiter for Bletchley because he'd be better positioned there to identify more people that could work at GCNCS. So this is our space for visitors to think about who and why people may have been needed before they were even brought to Bletchley Park. And also a chance for us to say that these people who were identified as likely candidates were trained before war broke out, before they ever worked at GCNCS, in things like basic code breaking, codes and ciphers, and so on.
Well, when we did our It Happened Here episode on early days, a lot of that was based on the initial research that Tom did for this.
Absolutely.
That stood out as something, you know, that I'd never thought of, that in January 1939, Alan Turing has to sit basically a code breaking 101 course because we know Turing as a code breaker.
Mm.
Well, he wasn't. You know, in January 1939, so he has to sit a course to see if he'll do it.
And these people were coming from different backgrounds, mathematical, linguistic, or classics backgrounds. And so I can't help but think it must have been an opportunity, well, for GCNCS to see if they could do it, but also for them to test their own aptitudes to see if it was work that they themselves would be willing to do. There must have been a bit of a two-way test going on.
So. Well, Tolkien doesn't come here, does he?
Exactly, exactly. And we don't know whether that was he decided not to or he simply wasn't chosen. We don't have the records for that. But there are so many people on the list of individuals that we only have their surname and their first initials. We don't know, particularly with the women that were identified, we just don't know who they are. It's kind of an ongoing mystery, really, which obviously we do love those here at Bletchley Park.
On the whole, I should say that the possibility of avoiding war has not increased during the day. Government circles are, in fact, exceedingly pessimistic. But there is a general belief that the strategic position is improved, that Hitler is hesitating, that the Russians may betray the Germans. There is still hope that Hitler may pause and think again. There is still the possibility of a conference. The people with whom I have talked in London today certainly haven't expressed any optimism, but their spirit is better. They believe the Germans are worried and uncertain, if not frightened, and that's a pleasant situation to most Englishmen. They think, rightly or wrongly, that they now have the initiative, that if war comes, they will win it. But that if we have a conference instead, the result is likely to be only a postponement. No one could truthfully say that the alliance with Poland has ever aroused any popular enthusiasm in Britain. Britishers know very little about Poland. The necessary historic and sentimental ties are missing. But the matter is not now so much one of Poland as it is of Britain's pledged word and the determination to move in one direction or the other out of this twilight of peace. Hitler has made his demand. Now he pauses. Britain is moving up to the line, and I should be less than truthful if I fail to report that some people see it coming with almost a sense of relief. They feel that perhaps war is the only solution. I don't know, but the decision must be made. The folks here seem to think it will be made during the next 36 hours. I return you now to America.
That is probably a daft question. Is there one document that stood out in all this research that you went, oh, this is amazing?
Yeah, there was actually. I think we might have used it in the other podcast. It's the letter Denison writes to Sinclair's successor, Stuart Mingus, on 12th of September 1939. Laying out some of the problems they're experiencing at Bletchley and how he wants to fix them, especially with the accommodation, because they, by this point, the organisation is getting bigger. They're running out of space in the mansion to work, getting on top of each other. It's too chaotic and noisy a situation for them to work effectively. And he's saying this is causing problems and it's only going to get worse. At the start of the Bletchley Park story, GCNCS is a bit of a Cinderella organisation. Doesn't get the attention it really deserves. And Denison doesn't have the influence to demand everything that it needs, especially in terms of accommodation. quite a silly situation where the codebreakers are quite happy here, actually. Even though they don't have ample space, they've got just about enough and things are working okay, and then war breaks out and the rest of MI6 turns up. You have Section D, which is involved in sabotage operations. It will go on to become part of the Special Operations Executive. Yeah. They have a workshop here for testing out explosives. You can imagine what a distraction that was. So very quickly, when London doesn't get bombed into the ground, some people go back to London and they go to various other places. Section 8, the communications section, goes down the road to Wadden Hall. Of course, they're initially at Bletchley Park, and that is when they have their radio station here, which is still called Station X.
September 1939. My dear Mingus, I'm sending you herewith a memorandum which Travis and I have drafted, as I had the Admiral's permission to discuss administrative details with you. The whole question will shortly become so acute that it will have to be laid before him for decision, but in the meantime I wish to make you fully aware of the present position and of future requirements. In addition to the present policy, which has forced GC and CS into disintegration, which I have always held to lead to a real loss of efficiency, I take the opportunity of repeating to you the discontent in the staff of GC and CS, which is now becoming increasingly vocal, with the actual conditions of work. The contention is that GC and CS, a civil service organisation, was moved out of London by orders of the Admiral, and not by orders of the Foreign Office, our administrative head, and that therefore the GC and CS must receive equality of treatment with the SIS, who were also moved by the Admiral's order. Travis and myself and senior assistants now occupied far less senior positions in the service, and many of our recruits are men of considerable distinction, and it is definitely felt that in the allocation of accommodation, such facts should be taken into account. It appears to me improper to invite such as these to try to do work requiring a high degree of concentration in overcrowded rooms. Again, the question of billeting, which Captain Ridley has carried out with such tact in the face of difficulty, has forced staff to live many miles from their work, and the question of transport is involved. It is felt that official cars can be made available from members of SIS, but GC and CS has had to raise a force of volunteers from among its own members and ask them to give their time and their cars to help their colleagues. In fine weather, it's hard for a man who has had a heavy day to forego his leisure for this. In the dark evenings to come, it will be even harder. If there are not sufficient official cars to do this duty, would it not be possible to engage the WVS to deal with the transport of the staff between office and billets? I have done a great deal and will do all I can to maintain the spirit of cooperation, but there is a real spirit of discontent growing among my colleagues. I have congratulated them on the good work that is being done under very trying conditions, and the natural reply is, improve our conditions and you will get more results. The few days that have elapsed since the outbreak of war are sufficient to show that we may hope very soon to contribute intelligence of a definite military value to the fighting services. If, however, we are to function efficiently, we must be reasonably housed. These are the main considerations. 1. Cooperation between the three service sections is essential. 2. All sections should be in close proximity to the teleprinter room, for a great part of the raw material used by all sections is transmitted from the Y stations and some of the cable offices. It should be remembered that the Foreign Office agreed to spend £4,000 a month to ensure this rapid means of communication for its own ultimate advantage. I have always viewed with very grave concern the fact that the military section has been moved to the garden to make room for mess, which is used for 1 hour per day, and the air section is also being moved away from the teleprinters to make way for a registry. The air section should be right on top of the teleprinters in the naval section, with whom it may have to confer urgently and frequently. The section working on the machine problem is in Number 3 Cottage, and development there is becoming much more hopeful, and here again they require very close cooperation with the section for whom they are working. The diplomatic and commercial sections are in St. Helmer's School. Although these sections are called diplomatic, certain of them require collaboration with the service sections, and produce a matter of military importance. 20 minutes spent walking backwards and forwards on a dark winter's afternoon is not going to make for efficiency. Further, the naval section is now grossly overcrowded, and we have to remember that we have added to our staff volunteers of very considerable standing, and the research work they will undertake is of extreme national importance, and one which calls for some degree of comfort in their surroundings, in order to get the best out of them. It must be remembered that the 3 weeks we have been here have been remarkably fine, and the walking about has been pleasant, if wasteful. With dark afternoons and evenings and cold conditions, people will hesitate to walk out in the open considerable distances to confer with their colleagues. In our overcrowded state, the use of the telephone, never satisfactory, is impossible. It seems that there is not room to house SIS and GCNCS in Bletchley Park efficiently. The only alternative, therefore, is to separate. It appears to be most difficult to move the teleprinters and provide lines for them, and it therefore remains to examine whether alternative accommodation can be found for some or all sections of SIS.
I think we especially liked that because it allowed us to probably paint a better picture of Commander Denniston than was portrayed in a certain Hollywood film, shall
yes,
we say.
Which we're always eager to do.
Yes. He did care about his staff, didn't he?
Absolutely.
And I know that was close to your heart, wasn't it, wanting to do that?
He cared very much about staff, probably almost too much at times. That is the source of his downfall in the end, that he finds it easier to give people free rein and to support them in doing their own work their own way than keeping a tight grip on things. And as the organisation gets bigger, he does start to lose his grip on it.
Is there a specific date or just a gradual thing, you know, where we know that this is no longer the SIS war station, but it's now specifically GCNCS?
Well, there are always SIS staff here. And actually, during the first couple of years of the war, SIS is still managing this site. And that causes a really tricky situation, actually, of sort of dual control, where SIS are making the decisions, but GCNCS are actually having to deal with the decisions. So there's a mismatch between the people running the place and the people actually who know what needs to be done. Alan Bradshaw is the GCNCS administrator who's put in charge of that side of things quite early in the war. But for the first couple of years of the war, nobody's listening to him. And Captain Ridley of the SIS is managing the site really without Bradshaw's input. And that causes big problems. It's from early 1942, around the time Denniston is replaced by Travis and things start to get rationalised. And they decide finally that GCNCS sort of has to manage its own affairs and it has the right to do that. And then things start getting put on a better basis.
That's when it needs Travis as the kind of more official.
Yeah, tough man. Mm. Again, that's a slightly unfair stereotype of Travis, maybe. On the other side, I think Travis was actually a very personable guy as well, who had very good relationships with the people he worked with, but he also had that hard-nosed attitude when it was needed. But that document showed a really interesting intersection between, as I say, the procedural day-to-day running of things and Denniston's attitude and his personality and character and his relationships with his superiors as well. That's a really interesting and important part of this early day story, actually, is that Denniston's control runs through the whole story, but he is constrained, and most importantly, he's constrained by the people who are above him in the hierarchy. He doesn't have total control of Bletchley Park, and there are limits to his power and to what he can organise. And he has to negotiate with people like Sinclair and Mingus, you know, to make sure things at Bletchley Park work as well as they possibly can. His influence touches on all these different points that we choose to emphasise, whether it's recruitment again and looking at how it was organised at first and the work they were doing, and also the experiences of the way the organisation was managed in the early period.
When war was declared, GCNCS was in action at its war station, already in process of growth towards that vast and successful body whose full story will perhaps never be told.
From Commander Alistair Denniston, writing in 1944.
These are today's main events. Germany has invaded Poland and has bombed many towns. General mobilization has been ordered in Britain and France. Parliament was summoned for 6 o'clock this evening. Orders completing the mobilization of the Navy, Army and Air Force were signed by the King at a meeting this afternoon of the Privy Council.
The German foe begins its ruthless march of conquest. Poland's 34 million inhabitants, crushed, scattered and enslaved. Tens of thousands of square miles of territory shrink before the movement of lightning-armored columns. Poland and the world learn the meaning of a grim new word, Blitzkrieg. The spark is set off in the free city of Danzig. Germany called it liberation, the excuse for Hitler's hordes to begin their destructive campaign of conquest. On September 1st, Danzig is incorporated into the Reich, and all Europe is aflame.
Als alter Soldat des Weltkrieges befindet sich der Führer seit Beginn des Feldzuges an der Front bei seinen Soldaten.
It is stated in London on the highest authority that if the proclamation of Herr Hitler should mean, as it would seem to mean, that Germany has declared war on Poland, Great Britain and France are inflexibly determined to fulfill to their uttermost their obligations to the Polish government.
We're at scene four now then.
We are. We are most of the way through the exhibition and now we reach the outbreak of war.
Finally.
Finally, war has been declared and in this scene we've pinned it to the day of the 4th of September 1939, the morning after war is declared, which was a Sunday. So Monday morning, bright and early, in the office at Bletchley Park, we wanted to show visitors who was at Bletchley Park on that day, where they were, and what work they were doing, because Tom has been doing a lot of work and has been able to identify all of those things.
This is London. You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
Is there anything that you're particularly proud of or you think that you've done something special or maybe unique?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the first and only opportunity we've had to give a picture of what the entire organisation looked like, down to the names of individual people and the sections they were working in. As I said, a lot of my research focused on the question of recruitment, and what this boiled down to is basically making a big spreadsheet full of names of individual people and trying to track them down and verify the dates they were here. And that was a lot of detailed, methodical sort of detective work that went into that. The upshot of all that is that we were able to give in the exhibition a picture of what the organisation looked like on the 4th of September 1939, the day after war breaks out,
right. And
name everybody. And we know what almost all of them were doing. And you can come and read those names and see how things were laid out. And we thought it was important to take that opportunity to do it here, firstly, because we can do it. Later on in the war, there are very few opportunities. The documentation is threadbare. They do make one list of all the staff at the end of 1940. But after that point, there are so many different authorities with a hand in the Bletchley operation.
Right.
They all have the different administrators. They're not talking to each other. Bradshaw's in the middle trying to coordinate things, but he has limits to his power. So there is no list of staff at Bletchley later in the war.
And there never is a comprehensive one after that date,
no.
Is there?
No, there isn't. So we've had to look at our roll of honour, which is publicly available. We've had to build that up from scratch, mostly from the veterans approaching us rather than the wartime documentation, because that picture of what the agency looks like just doesn't exist. But at the start, we can do that.
Because it's still only these, about 150 people?
Yeah, it's 185 people actually on the organogram who we are able to name. We base that on a few sources. I said before about the organisation doing admin when it had to. Mm. One of the things they have to do when they come to Bletchley is billet everyone.
Right.
Well, initially they're in hotels, inns, guest houses, B&Bs, because the necessary legislation hasn't been passed to billet them in private houses. Later on, they do that. When they're thinking about coming to Bletchley in July 1939, they draw up a list of staff, and that's very handy for us. And at the start of 1940, when these billeting acts come in, they draw up another list of everyone who's entitled to billeting allowances. And it's just these quite dull admin documents. They would have been a pain to put together at the time, but for us, they're an invaluable record. And we're able to cross-reference the July list with the list from the following February and then work out who came to Bletchley and confirm they were at Bletchley and then confirm that they stayed at Bletchley. And we have that later list from December 1940, which again gives us a point we can cross-reference with. They gave me a framework which I could start to fill with all the other sources we have. We obviously have a lot of accounts of people. Quite often they remember the day they arrived. They're able to give us the actual date because it's, you know, it's an important event in their life. So that enabled us to pin things down. We also have correspondence between Denniston and his seniors at the Foreign Office telling them who he brought on and the dates they'd arrived. So that gives us more information. So we're able to build up quite a detailed picture just around August and September, October 1939, about the rate at which people are coming in. And I actually got a calendar and I plotted it out with the names of people as they arrived, which was really nice to be able to do.
Did you get excited when you saw the day Turing arrived?
Well, yeah. What's nice about Turing is he arrives the day after war breaks out on the 4th of September.
And do we know that completely, 100% now?
Yes. So I can prove that. I can show you a piece of paper that says it. What's interesting is some people arrive earlier than Turing. He's not the top of their list.
No.
GCNCS comes to Bletchley on the 15th of August, and a couple of weeks before war breaks out, they start to draw these people from the emergency list and they start dropping in. And that's presumably because the work they were doing was ramping up even before war broke out. And they had a pretty good idea that it was going to happen and that Germany was going to act against Poland pretty soon. And they wanted to be ready for it. And then obviously war does break out and then people start to flood in. And then actually it goes quiet because Denniston is always worried about taking in too many amateurs at once, diluting the skills of his workforce, allowing his veteran staff who really know their work to be crowded out. So he actually slows down recruitment. He doesn't recruit all the people he's allowed to by the Treasury. They've given him the money, but he doesn't use it because he's being very cautious. He doesn't want to take too many people on too quickly. And then more people from the emergency list join in sort of dribs and drabs all the way through the end of 1939, early 1940. And that starts a process which goes on really for the entire war. And the organisation just steadily increases, gets bigger and bigger. Even doing that process, that cross-referencing process, it means there are gaps in what we can prove. There are things which we can say we're pretty sure about, but we can't necessarily say I couldn't prove it in court sort of thing.
Yeah.
So if somebody's on that July list, we make the assumption that they came to Bletchley. But if they're not on the list the following February, because some people arrive and then they leave again, you know, for all sorts of personal reasons, because the work doesn't agree with them. Some people go off and join the army because they think there's more important things to do. And Denniston actually isn't able to keep them here. In those cases, we can say that we're pretty sure somebody came to Bletchley, but we do not have a piece of paper saying they were at Bletchley on the 4th of September. So even at the best of times, there is a certain amount of conjecture that we have to do. But the point is we've cross-referenced all this information with as many sources as we can possibly find.
Are you especially proud of that? Because like I joked earlier, you know, the story is there's Captain Ridley's shooting party and then the next year Bletchley parts here. And, you know, and the next point of that is Turing arrives on such and such a date. But I guess with the organogram, you widen out that picture. You're including everyone, aren't you? It's not just about one person, which is what we tried to do here, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's about broadening it out. It's about giving everyone their place in the exhibition for them to be sort of memorialised almost. That we can do that is absolutely fantastic. It's certainly not just about Turing, although he's one of the most important figures. They take on a great number of recruits, many dozens. Turing is only one of them.
Yeah.
Most of them aren't mathematicians like him. Most of them are classicists, and that gives us a different perspective on it. They are recruiting this sort of classical model of codebreaker. After war breaks out, even though they are confronted with Enigma, they have all those old problems which they still have to deal with. That's where a lot of their attention goes. So it allows us to rebalance the picture in that sense as well. And I think hopefully for the visitors, the benefit of the organogram will be to give them a picture of what it looks like that they can grasp and take forward later on. And they go on to learn a lot about Enigma and about things like Lorenz, which they should because the impact of those code-breaking achievements are all important. But this exhibition gave us an opportunity to talk about things other than Enigma. The free service sections, military, air and naval section, they all continue to exist and do important work later in the war, and they often don't get the attention they really deserve. So this was an opportunity to talk about them. And there's also the civil side of things. There's a diplomatic section and a commercial section who don't deal with the military at all. And at the start of the war, those sections are some of the largest, and they're producing some of the sort of most immediately useful material. And again, they go on to do very, very important things, but they tend to be left out of the Bletchley story. The most important reason for that being that they're not actually at Bletchley Park for most of the war. They actually go back to London. And when Denniston is removed from Bletchley, that's his job. He oversees the civil side of the organisation at Berkeley Street in London. But again, those people deserve to have some recognition here if we can give it to them.
The news in the papers was grave enough, but there was still nothing in our material to indicate that Germany was on the brink of war. Early in the morning of the 31st of August 1939, I met the Admiral's deputy, Colonel Mingus. I made some fatuous remark about another quiet night, to which the Deputy Chief of the Secret Service replied tersely, "Heavy fighting all along the Polish frontier."
Extract from a post-war written account by Josh Cooper, head of air section at GCNCS.
Also in scene four, we wanted to evoke this scene of war has just broken out and get that kind of atmosphere. So we have a 1940s radio playing actual radio programmes or edits of a BBC radio programme from the 4th of September 1939, saying various sort of headlines of the radio news about events that were happening right at the start of the war. And for visitors who have heard this soundscape around the exhibition, sounds of typewriters and telephones and shuffling of papers, perhaps, and vehicles outside, this is something a little bit different and really pins this scene to that point in history. We also have a sort of secondary area of the scene because we have mentioned the locations where people were working on site. We've also been able to mention Elmer's School, which was a school that was taken over by GCNCS next door to the park and used throughout the war, but also the huts. And we went into a bit of detail about what buildings were on site in our previous early days episode of the podcast. But in the exhibition, we actually have the key to hut four, the key.
The actual key.
To the door, yes, displayed proudly in that scene as well, because it just makes that point that on the outbreak of war, there were four huts already standing. It wasn't something that war's broken out, let's start building extra buildings because the organisation is growing. And Tom has reiterated to me again and again with the discussions we've had about this organogram that we were able to display, how these teams just change, everything changes constantly. And the organogram for the 5th of September would probably look a bit different and bigger as well. And so it's the growth and the change that was constantly happening. That sense as well is something we've tried to put into scene four, which has a feeling of scene two, that element of paperwork and desks, but a bit more established now. There is a bit of organisation. We have filing trays. We have actual furniture rather than trestle tables.
They've kind of learned from their mistakes somewhat.
Exactly. And they've already been at work at Bletchley for a good period of time at this point. They're established. The outbreak of war doesn't hit Bletchley as a sudden thing. And that's what we wanted to show in this scene, that important work just continued and grew, and that the outbreak of war had been anticipated. Our visitors will have seen in the three previous scenes as well, the movement to Bletchley and the activity that took place there during Captain Ridley's shooting party and the early recruitment of people. And that all feeds in to the organisation that Denniston was able to spearhead so that the organisation could accept the outbreak of war and continue its important work.
Now, I get the impression here in Berlin that the people have pretty well recovered from the first shock of Britain and France coming into this war. People thought that with the two big Western powers in, they would see terrible air raids and all that. But with the best part of the week gone by, at least those in Berlin have seen neither enemy planes nor bombs nor even leaflets, nor have they heard anything about an attack on the West Front. The only war news they've had is about the victorious counterattack, as it's called here, against Poland. I thought the faces of those on the streets were therefore a little bit brighter today. As to the blockade, I don't think the average German has thought about it yet. The Minister of Interior tonight ordered all British citizens to report to the police within 24 hours, and after that they may not leave town without police permission. But note that the order does not apply to the French. The Germans still seem to put the French on a different footing from the British. I don't know why, but they do. This is William L. Shire in Berlin, returning you to Columbia in New York.
Well, I guess that takes us to scene five.
It does. Our final scene, also at Bletchley Park. And in this scene, we wanted to emphasise the sections, the various sections at work at Bletchley Park and what they were doing. And in this scene, we have this wonderful opportunity to display some objects, a group of artefacts.
Oh, right.
And I've already said that there's very little has survived from the time. And so it's quite a treat to be able to show examples of the early work, things like German-English dictionaries that we know were used by the team. They have a GCNCS and a GCHQ stamp in the front and are on loan from GCHQ. But we also have paperwork, from that time, looking at different codes the different teams were working with, and really the sort of tools of the trade of the time, stuff that ordinarily would have either been bunged on a shelf and just used as a reference book, or potentially gone into the bin because it's just not the sort of material that would have survived. And so it's either items from our collection or items on loan from GCHQ that really show the variety of work on German, Italian, Japanese, countries that weren't even in the war at this point, but also working with the French, and the various avenues of work that the different sections were doing, which we also then emphasise in a film nearby that shows examples of that early work and some early successes of each of the sections at Bletchley Park.
All cinemas, theatres and other places of entertainment are to be closed immediately until further notice. In the light of experience, it may be possible to allow the reopening of such places in some areas. They are being closed because if they were hit by a bomb, large numbers would be killed or injured. Sports gatherings and all gatherings for purposes of entertainment and amusement, whether outdoor or indoor, which involve large numbers congregating together, are prohibited until further notice. This refers especially to gatherings for purposes of entertainment. But people are earnestly requested not to crowd together unnecessarily in any circumstances. Churches and other places of public worship will not be closed.
Tom, can you maybe go into a bit of detail of how you put together these case studies that are in the film that Eric has spoken about?
The difficulty here was trying to give an impression of quite a complex situation without overwhelming the visitor who's just been introduced to Bletchley Park, hopefully come here pretty much first, has just been in the previous scene introduced to the concept that there are different sections here. And now we're talking about what they were doing. But at the same time, it was important for people to really take on that enigma myth head on. This was not just about that small group of mathematicians in the cottage, as important as their work was. There was a lot more going on at Bletchley, and there was a lot more going on in the world than often people realise at this point in the war. It's not just about Poland and France and Britain. The British Empire is global. Its strategy is global. So the war is already global. And signals intelligence work sort of matches it. So there is work going on here on Italian material, even though Italy hasn't yet joined the war, but they are a strategic threat that has to be kept an eye on. And a lot of work going on Japanese already. Again, Japan isn't due to join the war for another couple of years. And I hope by talking about some of that, again, we will sort of signpost visitors to be aware of these things when they're visiting the rest of the museum and go, oh, that's where Japanese work ended up.
I guess the whole point of this is, I keep saying, is to flesh this out, isn't
it? Flesh it out, broaden it out.
And do you think you've done that?
I hope so. The way we approached this final film was to pick a nice example for each section of something it was doing. And we can't obviously say this is everything all the sections were doing. But here is a point that we're making an impact on the war. That's the other thing as well. So what? Why are these people at Bletchley? What are they doing? They're not reading Enigma yet, so that hasn't actually yielded an intelligence result. But there are things at Bletchley which are important, which are actively helping the war effort, even at this early stage. So we had to select some of those, but as I say, without leading to information overload.
You've spent an awful lot of your life so far studying. Now you've got to what, you know, we could call the real world and the coalface, say. The result of all that studying is your research now, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's still studying. Obviously the result is far more immediate and the reach is far greater, which is fantastic, obviously.
Here, you're reaching hundreds of thousands of people a year. I mean, that must be a really good feeling.
Yeah, it is. There's obviously a balance to be struck between the detail that we'd really like to talk about and obviously giving an experience that people can sort of absorb and that's approachable in a day's visit. But the reason I and David are here is to sort of fly the flag for academic integrity, I suppose.
Mm.
And for us to really have a very solid grasp about our story and to tell it in the most interesting way and in the way that's most respectful to the people who lived it. And I think people would be forgiven for making the assumption that we just read what's written in the books and put it in our displays. There's a lot more that goes into it than that.
Yeah.
And I really think we are at the cutting edge here. And yeah, what can I say other than that? It's a great privilege to be able to do that in the place where it happened.
My final question, Tom, bearing in mind that this is pretty much your first major exhibition, I guess, that you've had a really big role in. How proud are you of it?
Very proud.
I wish you could see the smile on his face. It's huge.
It's a privilege to work here and be able to come in here and be in this place every day and to be able to go to the archives and look at the documents as well. On its own, that's fantastic. And to be able to share it with people is even better. Now that we're getting large numbers of visitors again, it reminds us why we're here doing what we're doing. The amount of people we're able to reach who learn something and go away with seeing the world slightly differently, you know, especially the kids who might go away being inspired by what happened here. We get a very tangible feeling of how important it is to do what we do.
What do you want visitors to take away from this?
There is a lot to see and do in this exhibition. And so we know there's probably more in the exhibition than visitors will ever get to do. So there's a theme running through it that I've tried to reiterate throughout the different activities, the different bits of multimedia, through all the writing as well, which is that the mansion, the building that our visitors are standing in, their very feet are on the very ground, is the place where Bletchley Park's code-breaking story began, and that Bletchley's early teams had to work together and overcome challenges to meet the growing threat of war. And that's the atmosphere that we want people to leave with, even if it's just a feeling rather than facts. If people leave wanting to know more about that, then I think I will have succeeded.
I think it plays into our exhibitions in the rest of the park, because our big changes back in 2014, we wanted to show what life was like in the huts.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a continuation of that, isn't it? You know, because they're so different, these periods of the code breaking at Bletchley Park. You know, by the end of the war, everyone's in these purpose-built blocks. The middle of the war, they're all in these quickly thrown-up huts. But we're going right to the very beginning, aren't we, with this?
We are, and I think that's something that benefited from all these different perspectives of the people who worked on this project, our designers, our scriptwriters, our amazing historians, without whose work we just simply couldn't have even had a starting point. The people who did the building of the exhibition itself as well, and our AV developers, everybody working together. And I think what they've created is a space, a room, and a feeling that people can go in and get a sense, exactly as you say, of somewhere a bit different. It's not the huts with the wonderful set dressing that we have in there, as if codebreakers have just got up and walked away. And it's not the blocks, like visitors can see in Block C, with all the bricks and the really sort of solid structures. This is lighter and it's a little bit more uncertain, which again echoes the sense that it must have been at the time. A sense of change and growth and challenge.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.